Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, and as a young boy dreamt of being a sports broadcaster. He broke into radio in 1980 in Grand Rapids and joined WJR in 1995. In 2000, he joined the legendary Ernie Harwell as the Tigers' play-by-play announcer for the middle innings, and in 2003, took over as the Tigers' lead announcer. Famous for his trademark sayings, one being, he got him on strikes, his name, Dan Dickerson. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the voice of the Detroit Tigers, Dan Dickerson. Dan, welcome. An honor to have you.
How are you, Jack? Good to see you.
Thanks. Can we start by talking about your childhood and
sure.
Your mom and your dad, please?
Where did you want me to start?
Just as a kid.
As you mentioned, grew up in Birmingham. It was really Birmingham and Rochester. So born at Beaumont Hospital on Woodward in Birmingham. Then we moved to Rochester in the, early 60s, 63, 64. And then we lived there for about 5 years. Now, what I loved about that was we were, before it got terribly developed, it was actually a new build, but we had woods behind us. Lots and lots of woods that are now all condos or houses. But big backyard, train tracks on the back. We played on the, what's better than woods and train tracks, right? I really remember those years. So just that freedom to roam, that back path through the woods to our friend's house, which is probably half a mile away down the road, the Ryans, and, we just live in those woods and live outside. And it was a great, great house to have. And then we moved to Birmingham, and I remember it so vividly in 68 because I was 9 years old, and we were moving while the Tigers were in the World Series. And I remember listening to some of those games as we made the move from Rochester to Birmingham.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
Well, I would just say from both. First of all, you take responsibility for your own actions. They never preached a sermon, or Dad did a little bit. but it was more just how they lived their lives. You treat people all the same. Other than that, I'm watching my grandfather as well. We'd go to every summer, go to Des Moines, Iowa, and watch just how they treat people. Everybody, you treat the same. It's not you treat this guy better because he's in more of a position of power or has a big job, or this person because they don't. It's just treat everybody the same. Enjoy people. And I don't know, to me, that's the fun part of life, is getting to know people from all walks of life.
Speaking of enjoying, when did you become a fan of the Tigers?
End of 67, start of 68. So 67, I remember watching the end of that season, four teams within a game and a half of each other, 4 days left in the season, and that back-to-back doubleheader Saturday, Sunday. And we had a little 12-inch black and white, and I remember watching Dick McAuliffe ground into a double play to end the season on that fourth game in 2 days when they finished one game behind Boston. So that's my earliest memories of watching. I think my first game was actually earlier that summer, but that's when I just remember getting kind of hooked, getting caught up in that pennant race. And then the next year, I remember being at camp, and my dad would send letters of update to the 68 Tigers. And so the 68 team was, that got me hooked, absolutely got me hooked on baseball.
67 Red Sox, that's when Yastrzemski won the Triple Crown, I think, right?
Right.
Okay, when did you decide you wanted to be a sportscaster?
I'm not sure I ever just made a conscious decision. I remember my Aunt Barb sent me Strat-O-Matic Baseball. I think it was the year after the Tigers won the World Series, so 69. So Strat-O-Matic Baseball, you might be familiar with it. It's a card and dice game, but real players, real stats, and highly addictive. And so you roll the dice, and you look at the pitcher card or the hitter card, and you play a game. Well, I would play games endlessly. And you should see, I still have like 68 Tigers cards. They are worn out. But I would call the games. Drove my brother crazy, by the way. We'd play against each other, but I was announcing the games all. I mean, not a lot, but just here's a base hit into left, here's a home run to left. I mean, very basic, but I remember liking that a lot. I'd have a World Series every year and invite the family. Nobody ever came, but I enjoyed calling it. So I don't know. And when I went to Ohio Wesleyan and there was a radio station on campus, and basically if you showed up, you got an air shift. And once I did one game, a football game, I was hooked. And now whether I knew I was going to be a sports broadcaster at that point or not, I knew that that's what I really wanted to do and loved it. It was a long circular path to get there, but I probably got hooked starting with Stratomatic, but then at Ohio Wesleyan.
You started to get paid to do it in Grand Rapids, WMAX.
I probably should have had
was it $200,000 a year or $300,000 a year?
It was $160 a week. My take-home was $121. I remember that first check. I'd like to say that was a lot of money back in 1980, but it was not. You know, the funny thing is, I mean, that station in one year after I got there went from all news to gospel. I mean, I should have had an inkling that it might not last long in its current format. It was the only job offer I got out of college. I mean, there was a good reason for that. If you go back and listen to the tape I was sending out or hand-delivering, there was a reason people weren't jumping to hire me. That was the only offer I got. I was so happy to get it. I mean, I should have had a little inkling that they were having some money issues when I walked in, and it was typewriters back then, right, Jack?
Absolutely.
It was typewriters. There were no word processors even. We're still a few years away. So we were typing all of our scripts, and there was a lot of typing going on for an all-news station. And there was typing paper, but there wasn't enough for actually to get you through a day because they were rationing it. So you would get anything that came in the mail was precious, and all news radio stations get all kinds of press releases, obviously. So you would take those press releases, and once you decided you weren't going to actually do anything with it, like cover the story they wanted you to cover, you would put a big X over that and then flip it over, and the other side was that nice clean sheet of paper. That was your typing paper, an early sign that maybe this station wasn't going to make it a whole lot longer.
All right, how did you ever get back to Detroit?
It's because of my wife, Lorianne. We met in 83, and in the summer of 84, she was at the Grand Rapids Press. She got an offer to work, I believe first job was Copy 8, so just a kind of a foot-in-the-door job. She wanted to be a reporter, which is what she was in Grand Rapids, foot-in-the-door job at the Free Press. And she took it, and she ran with it. And so for 4 years, 84 to 88, we're commuting back and forth every weekend from Grand Rapids to Detroit. All the while, I'm trying to get to Detroit. Detroit radio is not giving me the time of day. Grand Rapids, it seemed like, might as well have been Copper Mountain or something. I mean, just small market. But even though it's a big market, to Detroit, it was a small market. It was. That was the perception. I couldn't get anywhere, any foot in the door. I always think of Roberta Giacina. She was the only one. She was the news director, I want to say, at Magic Radio. And she's the only one who gave me even the time of day. And she was so nice, but she didn't have a job available. So then I think, okay, I'll go to a smaller TV market and get a job in Lansing or Traverse City and work my way to a bigger market and then work my way to Detroit. That didn't work. I volunteered my time at Channel 13 in Grand Rapids trying to get a reporting job there. That didn't work. So, and after 3-4 years, I mean, we knew we were going to get married. It would have been nice to be in the same city. So after 4 years of me trying all these different things, and I mean, it's so funny when you think about it. I really was trying to get into TV. That was my way to get to Detroit. And when I got rejected by Lima, Ohio, the 210th largest market in the country out of 212, that was maybe a sign that that wasn't my path. So finally, I proposed to her in January, I believe, of 88 or December of 87. And we set a date. We're still in different cities, and we're just figuring the fates will align and something will happen. Well, her boss was Dave Lawrence. I mean, he was the publisher of the Free Press. But he knew Lori, liked Lori, heard of our plight, and Dave Lawrence didn't know me. He'd never met me, but he liked Lori. And knew that we wanted to get married and be in the same city. He wrote letters to WJR, WWJ, WXYT, saying and singing my praises. He didn't know anything about me other than I was going to get married to Lori, and said, you should give this guy a shot. Within 2 days after 4 years of searching, I got a phone call from WWJ offering me a part-time job on the weekends at WWJ. And so that was my ticket to get to Detroit, part-time weekends at WWJ.
God sends us angels all the time. When we come back, we're going to ask him, Dan Dickerson, about another angel in his life. And I'm Jack Russell, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Russell. We're with Dan Dickerson. An angel comes into your life named Chuck Schwersky.
Well, that was at WJR. So I've been at WWJ from 88 until 95. While I'm doing OJ updates, three and sometimes four times an hour at WWJ in 1995. Remember, that trial started in January and went way beyond the time I covered it. But I've been covering it for 3 months at that point. So we're into April, and I'm doing these updates three and four times an hour, listening to the trial, giving my little updates. And I got a call from Lloyd Jackson here at WJR and said, there's a sports opening at WJR. And I leapt at the opportunity. I'd done some sports, Lions coverage, mostly news at WJ. And so I called Chuck, and they had an opening for a reporter job here at WJR. In sports. And I'd never worked full-time in sports except for a little short time in Grand Rapids. So 15 years into my career, I've been mostly a news guy with some sports. And Chuck was willing to take that chance that I could be one of his, you know, sports reporters on his staff. So he hired me that April. And the biggest thing he did for me, I was always working on my play-by-play. I would go to the Silverdome and record a Lions exhibition game. Ray Bentley even came over from Grand Rapids. He now does national games. We were both trying to get a job in play-by-play. He was doing the color. So we put together a tape, and I gave that tape to Chuck and said, I really want to do play-by-play. Here's my play-by-play. And he said, okay. And that fall, so fall of 95, Frank Beckman does Tigers baseball and Michigan football. Well, the overlap in September, they needed someone to do five games that year, actually, before Frank came back in October. And so they had hired somebody, and after two games, it was evident that that person needed to be replaced for reasons that were obvious. And so I'm doing sidelines for Michigan football, and they called Chuck, and I was there when he got the call. Chuck, we need to make a change. Before Frank comes back, we have three games. Can you do those games? Chuck did Michigan basketball. I'm sitting right there, and he goes, no, I've heard Dan's tape. He's ready. So instead of taking what truly is one of the most fun things you'll ever do in sports broadcasting, call a college football game at a major university, Michigan State, wherever you want to be. It's a great, I mean, it's so fun. The atmosphere, all about it. I love everything about it. He says, no, he gives it that opportunity to me to do three games. So probably the single biggest break in my career that now, instead of calling high school basketball or football in Grand Rapids, I get to call a major sport in a major market. And then for the next 3 years, while Frank continued to do Tiger baseball, I got that chance to do those Michigan games in September. So I got to do a couple of Notre Dame games. I got to do a bowl game 1 year when Frank was having surgery, and I got to get down to San Antonio and do a bowl game. So, I mean, great experience. But now you're a guy who's done a major sport in a major market, not a guy who used to do high school games in Grand Rapids. It was a big difference. That led to Michigan basketball for a couple of years, and then eventually led to the Tigers job in 2000. But that break was, I mean, just the fact that he didn't even hesitate. No, Dan deserves this shot. That was amazing.
Another angel. For 3 years, you were with Ernie Harwell on the Tiger road trips. You shared cab rides, meal with him. Tell us about Ernie Harwell.
I always say that as nice as you think he was even nicer in person. I mean, you just, that day-to-day, how he treated people, and I mean, people would come up to the booth or he'd be introduced to people. I mean, he was a rock star in this town because of all the decades he'd been calling Tiger games. And it was always, tell me about yourself. What do you do? It was always just whenever that person would meet Ernie, they were so excited to meet him, and you'd just watch him turn it around. so it's so nice to meet you. What do you do for a living? Tell me. You know, I mean, he would just instantly bond with that person, make them feel at ease. And I'm a stats guy. I love the numbers. That drew me into baseball. It did. I liked figuring out batting averages and earned run averages. And then Ernie, just that reminder that, I mean, he would go into the opposing clubhouse and pop his head in the manager's office, say, "Hi, Ernie Harwell." Like, he had to introduce himself, but he always did. "Yeah, I know Ernie." but that idea that you're always making sure you're touching base with people and not forgetting the human side of the equation, the stories that go along with the people behind the numbers. And I'm still a numbers guy, but I mean, that was just a great reminder to see, here's a guy who's been doing it for how many decades? In his 80s, and he's still just working the beat, if you will. And that's a great reminder, and it really did influence how I go about my day-to-day business today.
He was famous for saying, whenever you have the choice of being right or kind, always choose kind. His recall, Dan, was unbelievable.
Oh, it's just phenomenal. I mean, and that's, I think, because of the way, you know, you start calling games in the 1940s, there were no game notes, there were no media guides, there was obviously no internet. So, I mean, he would clip newspaper articles and get the stories behind the players. And, yeah, that kindness always stood out. And it, you could tell it came through on the air. And I think people do know that. It's hard to be a jerk and come through as a nice guy on the air.
September 29th, 2002, Ernie Harwell's last game.
In Toronto. And I had not a front row seat, because that's a really small booth, but right behind him, I got to watch him. You know, the thing that struck me was just, as I listened to it, I thought, this is amazing. I mean, I grew up listening to Ernie Harwell, and he sounds just as good, and I mean that. I mean, he felt like he was slowing down a little bit in terms of staying up with it, but you just didn't hear it. I mean, he sounded just as good. The voice was just as strong as when I was growing up. And I just found that amazing, because I really was listening and just thinking, this voice is timeless. And there has been no visible, or, you know, if you're listening, you don't notice any change in his delivery and how he calls a game. It's still just as enjoyable. It was remarkable, but it was special to be able to have that seat watching him call his last game, just like the seat watching that last game at Tiger Stadium.
We're talking to Dan Dickerson, and I'm Jack Wasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Wasula, and with Dan Dickerson, who took over as lead play-by-play announcer in 2003, after Ernie Harwell retired. Okay, 2003, you're the lead announcer. The Tigers go 43 and 119. That's worse than my Cubs ever did, Dickerson. Tell us about that year.
Oh, my gosh. Where do you start? I guess you start with the beginning, which is the Tigers starting 3-25. And truly, the good thing is, I'm the guy who's, quote-unquote, replacing Ernie Harwell. I always say the guy who, after Ernie. So I'm under the radar at this point. I mean, there were times during the middle of the summer when you're thinking, we could thank our individual listeners personally.
Even your mom.
Stephen Sterling Heights, thanks for listening tonight. So they start 3-25, and you do the quick math. I'm thinking, could they really be at some point 12-100? I mean, that's what's going on. I mean, how bad could this team be? Think about it. If a team's 20 or 30 games under 500, that's a bad team, right? This team at one point was 80 games below 500. That team may single-handedly account for the fact that I may never be above 500 in all my years of broadcasting Tigers baseball. And then I remember there are a couple of moments along the way, I think, that always stand out. First, Alan Trammell, the manager, his first year as manager, did a phenomenal job. And I mean that. I mean, here's a guy who's got nothing to work with. And I did the manager's show every day, and he found something to talk about every day. I mean, the teaching that was going on, the effort that was going into doing something to make these guys better, never got down in the dumps. I mean, I just can't imagine how hard that would have been to be the manager of a team like that. But he just approached it with, okay, what are we going to do today to get these guys better, to make them something more than what they are right now? It was amazing to watch, and the optimism and the positive outlook was phenomenal. Then there was a game in midsummer. I want to say it was August. The Angels were in town. They were good. Tigers were 60, 70 games under 500 at that point. Complete mismatch in the ninth inning. Troy Percival comes on, dominant closer. I think he'd given up 2 runs in 40 innings against the Tigers in his career. Utter dominance. Inge at the plate, 10-9 Angels, man on first. Brandon Inge is hitting 190, another mismatch, and he hits a walk-off two-run home run. And to break an 11-game losing streak, and it was one of those moments that remind you why you like baseball, because a great moment is a great moment. And I think that's why you like baseball, right? They get to home plate, a team that's had very little to celebrate, got to celebrate that moment. And I always think of that as a great reminder why people still come to the ballpark, why they still listen, maybe in fewer numbers, even when a team isn't very good. And then you get to that last week, and they're knocking on the door for 120 to tie the Mets' all-time record for most losses in a season, and they win 5 of their last 6 to avoid history, even though 119 is pretty close.
All right, on the flip side of the aisle, the 2006, the magical year.
Yeah, it really was something. Jim Leland takes over. He knew he had talent, and I think he kind of quietly, even though he didn't talk about it a lot, really felt that this was a team that could do something. They'd won 70-plus by Tram's third year. They were improving, but there was still that next step to take. And, you know, he delivered that early season address. After a game, I mean, he just ripped into them after one game before they're heading to the West Coast, because he felt like their minds were already on the plane heading to the West Coast before they went out and played Cleveland and got thumped. And he let them have it after the game. And that kind of just set the tone. It's like, no, if you want to be winners, there's a certain level that you have to bring of effort every day. And that always, to me, is a kind of key moment in a season when he turned some things around on the mental side of the equation. They lost a couple games after that, but then they went on that roll. And that team at one point was 76-36. I think that when they hit that mark in early August, that's when Pudge hit that amazing home run, another walk-off. And I just remember that moment stands out for me in that season just because it just seemed like every night it was somebody else hitting that big home run or driving in the key run or getting the key out late in the game. The complete team effort that and the ballpark was loud. And it was so much fun. That ballpark was rocking that summer. And there's so many great moments. And then leading up, of course, to the postseason and the Maglio home run. But there were just, it was
Talk
a fun team
that.
To watch.
Talk about that moment.
The Maglio home run was something because he'd already hit a home run earlier in the game. He really wasn't a home run hitter. He was an RBI man. He knew how to get guys home. He was due up 5th that inning. So it's tie game against Oakland, bottom of the 9th. He's due up 5th. And clubhouse guys are trying to figure out, do we put up plastic? Because if they win, they clinch and there's going to be champagne. Or do we wait? You don't want to put up the plastic and then they lose. They got to go to a game 5. And somebody came down to the dugout. And as the story goes, Maglio said, put up the plastic. We're going to win this. I'm going to get it done. Bottom of the 9th. But he's due up 5th. 2 outs, nobody on. Then 2 base runners, Monroe and Polanco. And so at that point, you're thinking, for me, I mean, that's my first taste of the postseason, this 2006 postseason. So you have to anticipate what might happen. You can't plan a call, obviously, but you have to anticipate. But so I'm anticipating, because he'd done it all year, a single to right fielder, a ground ball single to left, and Polanco is going to try to score from second base. And then he hits an absolute no-doubter walk-off home run, and I think you can hear it in my voice on that call. I mean, it surprised me, surprised everybody, and that ballpark was literally, Jack, shaking. I mean, you could feel the booth move.
The Tigers have beat the A's 6-3, completed a 4-game sweep in one of the greatest turnarounds in baseball history.
And it was so fun because my brother had come in from Washington. My wife was there, a bunch of friends right down below. And it was one of those magical moments that they'll never forget. But I just always remember that feeling of the ballpark and the joy that spilled out onto the streets after.
We're talking to Dan Dickerson, who's like a modern-day Dick Clark or a male version of Vanna White, in that he never gets any older, you know? And he is more than a pretty face. So, all right. Mr. I, who we lost a year ago.
Well, I just remember after the 2003 season when they had the team photo, and he didn't do long press conferences. He would usually get asked for a comment or two every year at the team photo. And I remember he said, this will not happen again. I think he was embarrassed that his team was going to maybe set the record for most losses. I mean, it was emphatic, quiet, but emphatic. This will not happen again. And while they didn't lay out what the plan was going to be, I think you knew that change was going to come. And that's, remember, when they went out and made the big splash for Pudge Rodriguez and then traded for Carlos Guillen and then signed Maglio Ordóñez. But it was that Pudge signing against all odds that reminded you, or at least it gave everybody the sense that this is an owner who wasn't going to sit by idly and let this franchise wallow at the depths of the American League. And that bold move to sign Pudge was a sign of what he was going to do. And really from 2006 on, but really starting in 2004, I mean, that's how he ran things. And Dave Dombrowski was given the opportunity to have a bigger payroll, and he masterfully not only signed free agents, but also went out and made some brilliant trades to put those pieces together. But, I mean, one of the most generous owners ever, I think, just it's amazing how generous he was with the players, but he cared about the players. I mean, he would be down in the clubhouse, not all the time, but often just to talk to them. Spring training, he'd come down. I think that's what I remember most, is he'd come down to spring training, sit in Jim Leland's office sometimes so that the media could come in and just chat with him. And he just had the look on his face like he was just like a kid again. He just loved being at spring training. And he just, you know, he'd joke a little bit, and he'd joke around with Jim Leland a little bit in that tiny little office in Joker Martin Stadium. And that's when you could really see his love for the game come out.
We're speaking to Dan Dickerson, who also has phenomenal love for baseball. And I'm Jack Russell, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the voice of the Detroit Tigers, Dan Dickerson. You said that Mr. I, after the 2003 season, said this will not happen again. Well, another thing that probably won't happen again is that we get to watch the ability of a man like Miguel Cabrera. LK Line told me the night that you were the MC with Rob Manfred, you know, that black tie event, I was sitting next to him. He said, Jack, Miggy is the best right-handed hitter I've ever seen in my life. And he's seen them all since 1953,
isn't
65 yards.
And he's not just saying that.
I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, and he's not just saying that. I mean, if he didn't think so, he'd say he's a great hitter. He'd pay him a compliment. But when he says that, he means it. And that, I love listening to Al when he stops in the booth to harass Jim and say hello. I mean, just when you ask him about players, the things that he sees, I mean, the vision that he has, that's why he's still around, and that's why he's still a valuable piece of this organization, because he just sees things that can help a hitter, help a fielder. So that carries a lot of meaning to me when he says that. So watch this guy. It's just been phenomenal. I don't know enough about hitting to know what makes him maybe the greatest, but just in terms of the balance. But I know that every time I see a slow motion side view of his swing when he's right, it is a thing of beauty. And you think most of the times you say a lefty swing because it does look prettier for some reason. But that is a beautiful right-handed swing. And that's why, I mean, the guys who are on Hall of Fame tracks age better than other guys. So anybody who thinks that he is done at 35 is A, premature, but B, not paying attention to history. The Hall of Famers age better through their 30s because the fall is from such a high level that even as they decline, they are still productive more so than well above league average. You look at Hank Aaron, you look at Willie Mays, through their 30s, these are very productive hitters. The great ones are David Ortiz was great through his 30s and even at 40. And that's why I think whatever the problems for Miguel were, and I think off-field, certainly there were some distractions, but two bulging discs in your back, that's a problem. But now they've figured it out. Brad Ausmus played with it. David Ortiz played with it in their 30s and remained productive. I mean, Brad's playing a demanding position and played with it. But you just have to learn how to take care of your back, how to manage that. So now that I think Miguel has that, I will not be surprised at all not only that he has a bounce back year, I mean, anything's going to be better than last year. I mean, he struggled through pain all year. If he's healthy, I know it's a big if, but I really believe he's figured out a way to make sure he takes care of his back. I won't be surprised at all. Everybody says this contract is an albatross, and it looks like that right now. I don't deny that. But because they've got him for, what, six more years, 180. That's a lot. And what, I'm not sure he'll what the worth will be in those 6 years, but I'm just telling you, I really believe, given good health, this is a guy who can be productive, as the Hall of Famers are, from age 35 through age 39, be a productive hitter and still be a force in that lineup. And when you've got Miguel Cabrera in the middle of a lineup, it makes everybody around him better.
All right. You've got a terrific tan because you've been in Lakeland for the last 2 months. But our 2018 season starts March 29th. We're playing the Pirates at home. What are we going to see this year?
I'm intrigued by two guys especially, because Chris Bosio, the new pitching coach, really has a knack for getting the most out of his pitchers. All pitching coaches have different methods, and some I just think are more successful at communicating what they want. There's some are better than others. And I just think Bosio is one of those guys who has that knack. They might have heard the same message from another pitching coach, but he just has a way of making sure it clicks. So Daniel Norris, Matthew Boyd are the two guys that I look at, because any team would like to have these guys. Boyd almost threw a no-hitter last year. Norris has number two starter stuff. But obviously inconsistent in their time in the major leagues. Wildly so. Daniel Norris' health has certainly been part of the issue. But in terms of his athletic ability and that golden left arm, it's a guy a lot of people would like to have. So to me, I always start with rotations. If you've got a decent rotation or an above-average rotation, and I know it's ifs, but Fulmer, I think, will be fine. Norris, Boyd, Zimmerman, Fiers. You've got the making of an above-average rotation if those guys click like I think they can. And then you're a competitive team. I don't know what the win total will be this year, but 64 wins last year, it's got to be better than that. Would you take a 10-win improvement with the improvement of Norris and Boyd and a bounce back from Zimmerman? That, to me, is a good start on the road back to where they want to be. I mean, it's going to be a process. But I think those are the keys for Tigers fans, plus whatever youngsters might develop and make an impact on this roster this year. But those two can really lead the way. And then you've got a young rotation that's got a chance to be an impact rotation in the years ahead.
All right, speaking of youngsters, let's talk about young fans who like constant action. In 2017... you told me the average length of time between a ball being put in play in the major leagues was 3.5 minutes, Dickerson.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Well, I think that's why the commissioner is so focused on pace of play, not time of game. In other words, let's keep things moving, and that's why pitch clock is going to be a part of this game, one way or another. So I think moving it along is good. Length of game, if there's more offense, you're going to have a longer game. But as long as it's moving, you're not having a lot of dead time between pitches, I do think that's important. I don't know how that number that I gave you compares to, say, 15 years ago, because I'm not sure anybody was tracking it back then. But it does seem like that's a lot of time. I've also read some interesting pieces this winter from younger fans. You hear that, you know, the audience is getting older for baseball. It's getting older for all sports in terms of who's going to the games. But the point that this younger writer in her 20s made was, you've got to make it affordable for them to get to games. That to her was a bigger issue than the pace of the game. Because you do hear that a lot, that, you know, young kids want games fast-paced and they're going to be distracted every 15 minutes because that's how they've been brought up. Her point was, no, if you move the game along, but more make it affordable so they can go to the games. She felt that was a bigger issue than anything else. And it's a good point when you think about it, that get to the games, now you're hooked. You're at a game, and you love everything about being at a game. But if you can't, the affordability, I think, is something that, you know, Major League Baseball just has to be aware of to get that next generation of fans, in addition to the emphasis on pace of play.
In 2007, the average team hit 151 home runs. In 2017, 10 years later, the average team hit 211 home runs. That's 60 more per team. That's a 40% increase in 10 years. These Yankees, those three guys, Judge, Stanton, and Sanchez, just the three of them might hit 210 home runs.
I was going to say, they might all
Why
hit 60.
Why so many home runs?
I do think it's a combination of things, but I think hitting styles you hear about, launch angles, but really if you look at the percentage, the breakdown, how many balls are hit on the ground, how many balls are line drives, how many balls are pop-ups and fly balls, that really hasn't changed significantly that I've seen yet in the last few years. So same ratio, same number of fly balls, basically. More of those fly balls are going out. So that would suggest the ball itself. In other words, there aren't a ton more balls being hit in the air, but a ton more are going out. And I thought the testing that, Will Bunch, I think, did last summer, was instructive because he really looked at the construction of the ball. Major League Baseball always says it's within the tolerances, but the tolerances are so vast that two legal baseballs, one can fly 49 feet farther than the other. The tolerances are a little bit on the high side, I would say. And what they found was the ball in 2015 versus the ball in 2017. The ball in 2017, lower seams, the way it came off when it was fired against a wood wall, and the size, weight, I mean, all these things, it was flying about 7 feet farther. Now think about that. The guys with the warning track power suddenly are hitting the ball over the wall. 7 feet farther is not a small amount. And that leads to more home runs. Giancarlo Stanton doesn't need the extra 7 feet. His home runs all go 450, it seems like. But for those guys who are the marginal ones, and when you look at the growth in home runs, look at the guys who are the 10 to 15 guys are suddenly hitting 25, maybe even 30 out of nowhere. Some have changed their swings. Others are just hitting more home runs. And I do think it gets back to the ball. It's not one simple thing, but it the fact that there are still the same basically number of fly balls and that many more are going out, I do start with the ball. And more than anecdotally, pitchers will tell you, that ball that just went out would have been a fly ball last year. They know. Justin Verlander talked about it. He knows what, if he makes a mistake and that ball is a 320-foot out, he knows what that feels like. He knows, okay, that pitch, that swing, that should be an out. And he started seeing those balls go over the fence at a much higher rate in recent years, and he's convinced it's the ball, and I do think there's something to that.
Dan Dickerson, if Ernie Harwell was still alive, and somebody asked him, Mr. Harwell, how do I learn to become kind? He'd say, well, just look at that Danny Dickerson and watch what he does. Thanks a million.
Thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure being here.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.
Believe in yourself.